Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Politicians can talk all day long, as we know. But oftentimes, if you really want to know what's going on, economics is where it's at. In Ukraine, follow the natural gas. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for the 4th of March. It's a Tuesday. Good as always to have you with us. In Moscow today, President Putin had a press conference in which he said he will use force in eastern Ukraine if, essentially, he thinks he has to. In Kiev, Secretary of State John Kerry offered Ukraine $1 billion in loan guarantees and said, essentially, the Russians were out of line. Markets here and in most of the world thought that was all fine and got back most of what they lost yesterday and then some. In commodities, natural gas prices dipped a bit in Europe, which will be of interest to the Russians, the second largest producers of natural gas in the world. The Europeans are big buyers of Russian natural gas. Europe relies on Russia for about a third or so of its supplies, which gives President Putin a whole lot of leverage. Or maybe it doesn't. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
It's a sensitive moment for Europe in terms of energy. Europe, and especially its largest economy, Germany, is trying to downscale use of nuclear power. Christopher Knittel is an energy economist at MIT. He says the only viable alternatives are coal and natural gas. And coal comes with lots of emissions.
So that would tend to link Germany with Russian natural gas even more strongly. That might be enough to give Russia the upper hand in terms of any negotiations.
And for Europe, getting natural gas from someone other than Russia would get really expensive. James Bushnell is an economist at the University of California, Davis.
The reason that natural gas is primarily a continental market is because it's pretty cheap to move it through pipelines, but it's very expensive to liquefy it and ship it by tanker.
The all-important natural gas pipeline from Russia to Europe goes through Ukraine.
This is a high-stakes game of poker, and it does look like Vladimir Putin right now has a definite advantage.
Phil Flynn is an analyst with the Price Futures Group in Chicago. He says the natural gas dependence between Europe and Russia does cut both ways.
The economic stakes are high on each side. I think Russia is betting that they won't turn this into a crisis because, you know, Russia themselves, 51% of their budget really is dependent on energy exports.
Flynn says in the short term, a disruption in the export of Russian natural gas to Europe would hammer Europe's economy. But in the long term, Europe would find an alternative, and Russia's economy could suffer far worse. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
In news o' business today, there was a big deal in the race to get consumers television over the internet. Disney and the Dish Network have come to an agreement that will let the satellite provider stream Disney's content. Even the biggies like Apple and Google haven't been able to share that kind of deal. But as with all things, there is a price. In return for the content, Dish will have to disable something called AutoHop, which lets viewers skip ads. It'll have to disable it on all Disney stuff for 3 days, which means, heaven forfend, you'll be forced to watch the ads. Marketplace's Queenie Kim has more now on the economics of the skip button.
Dish's AutoHop lets you get rid of commercials on TV with the click of a button. Jim Nail is an analyst at Forrester Research, and he says right now, broadcasters are getting around features like AutoHop by playing defense.
There's really two main tactics. One is the court system and sue people like Dish.
The second tactic is to disable the fast forward button. He says Comcast is doing this on their TV on demand service. Nail says long term, it's a losing strategy, but for now, advertising sales are holding steady. Ira Kalb teaches marketing at USC's Marshall School of Business, and he says shows like American Idol are taking a more creative approach. Recently, the talent show experimented with splitting the TV screen. On one part of the screen was the behind-the-scenes footage of contestants, which is a fan favorite.
At the same time, they showed some advertising content, and it was the logo of the company or the product. So formatting's another way to avoid ad skipping.
Then there's old-fashioned product placement, which has been around forever but is becoming popular again. Paul Sweeney is an analyst at Bloomberg Industries, and he says the future might be an amalgam of the old and new. He points to Samsung's coup at the Academy Awards, the 30-second ads, the product placements, and then there was this selfie of Ellen and a gang of movie stars, which was taken on a Galaxy. It got millions of retweets.
When you get that viral aspect to it, which we did with Ellen's tweet, that's really where a message can really live for a long time.
And You can't fast forward through a tweet. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Crimea? What Crimea? It's all good, y'all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Yes, the Affordable Care Act is the law of the land. Yes, the Supreme Court said it was mostly okay. And yes, the rollout has already started, although no, not as we are all aware, without some serious problems. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel was one of many giving advice and counsel to the White House as that law was being written. And he has now in turn written a book about what health care reform might eventually mean in this country. It's called Reinventing American Healthcare. Dr. Emanuel, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
Let's get the politics of this thing out of the way as much as possible. And I appreciate that that's a loaded statement. But you end the book saying, and this is a quote, "In the short term, the Affordable Care Act has been a political disaster for President Obama and the Democrats." Self-inflicted wound, right?
Yeah, I think it's a tremendous achievement. And I think, unfortunately, the communication strategy wasn't everything it should have been. And I think, obviously, the implementation initially in the first 2 months of the exchanges are both self-inflicted wounds. In general, the bill is actually going to dramatically improve the American healthcare system. And yet, I think that message has not been effectively communicated, unfortunately.
I'm also obliged to mention that the Obama administration and the people who are implementing this thing can't seem to get out of their own way in delaying implementations and making exceptions and doing everything that would seem to suggest that this thing is half-baked.
I don't agree with you.
Really?
Yes, I don't agree with you. The exchanges are happening. That's a key element. Many of the important rules and regulations, they're having a very big effect already in fixing the system. So I don't really agree with you. You're focused on one or two things like the employer mandate for big employers. Let's face it, most of those employers already provide insurance. The individual mandate, that's sticking, and that's actually going to make a big impact, I think, in convincing people to get insurance.
I want to ask you about Medicaid expansion. You knew going in that this was going to be a tough thing for a lot of Republican governors to swallow at the state level, yet you left it in there. The Supreme Court said you couldn't do that.
Supreme Court didn't say you couldn't expand Medicaid.
No,
what they said
they said was you can't be coercive about it.
Yeah, kind of penalty that we put in the bill was too coercive is what they said.
Why did you go that way then, if you knew it was going to be so hard?
Oh, well, we thought that the kind of penalty or the kind of incentives we provide. Remember, for the first 3 years on the Medicaid expansion, the federal government picks up the entire bill for Medicaid expansion, and then it slowly declines so that the federal government picks up 90% of the expansion. For most states, that's positive cash flow. The only thing keeping states from actually expanding Medicaid is ideology. It's not actually costs and benefits.
Well, just to get back to the politics of this thing for a second, and I said we were going to move away, but you recognize that this is all ideology, right? It's the role of government in society, and nowhere is that more fundamental than in healthcare.
Well, we thought that for many states, they also recognize that it's important to balance their state budget, that it's important to give people health care because they become more productive. They stop worrying about that element and can focus on jobs, raising their family, and other things. And we made it strongly in their interest to expand Medicaid.
Would you go to medical school today? I mean, you're a doctor. You've been on both sides.
That's a very complicated personal question you're asking.
All right. Give me the radio-approved answer then.
So I'll tell you, I think this is among the most exciting times in medicine. Many of the things that frustrated me during my training, for example, we'd have patients with emphysema come into the hospital. We'd work to make sure their breathing was better. We'd discharge them, and then they'd come right back 7 days later because no one was following up on, are they taking their medications? Do they have an air conditioner in the house when it's hot and they therefore don't get short of breath? Now, the health system will have a lot of incentives to do that follow-up, to actually go beyond simple health care interventions to take care of the whole patient. So I'm actually quite keen that this could be a real golden age where we can actually improve costs and really improve the welfare and the health of the average American who has an illness.
Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, he is the Vice Provost for Global Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. He is a physician, and he's got a new book out. It's called Reinventing American Healthcare. Zeke, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You know the toll booth, right? Driving, stopping, handing over the same 75 cents, or sometimes lots more depending on where you live, but handing it over to the same human being every single day. Or going through the fast pass lanes. Same deal, just faster. Seems so quaint in this era of what's called dynamic tolling, lanes that offer drivers a relatively free-flowing trip at a price that goes up and down with congestion. As with everything in which economics are involved, though, the law of unintended consequences is in full force here. From WLRN in Miami, Kenny Malone explains.
Kevin Serino is a man on a mission. Get home as quickly as possible.
Hey, it's me.
Serino has a 3-month-old son and an 18-month-old daughter. At 4 p.m. on the nose, Serino leaves his job at the University of Miami Medical School and checks in with his wife.
Okay, so I'm going to stop at Publix on the way home. Would you need anything?
When Kevin Serino leaves in the morning, his 18-month-old, Scarlett, is asleep. She goes to bed 4 hours from now. Every minute Serino wastes in traffic cuts into that precious family time. He throws his bag in a blue Chevy Cobalt he calls the Millennium Falcon and drives to his I-95 on-ramp, where an electronic sign will tell Kevin Serino his fate.
It looks like the toll is $7, so I'm not taking the express lanes today.
On the surface, this is a perfect example of how dynamic tolling is supposed to work, says the man behind the curtain.
That day you pay $7, we're trying to get you not to go there.
Traffic engineer Rory Santana has been running the I-95 express lanes in Miami since they opened 5 years ago. But over the last several years, record numbers of drivers have been willing to shell out the maximum toll of $7, which has been a problem for Santana.
If it's $7 and everybody piles in, we lost that opportunity to try and keep the speed up and keep the flow going.
Santana's seeing a strange express lane phenomenon, one recently documented by David Levinson at the University of Minnesota. Levinson looked at driver behavior on MinPass, one of the earliest dynamic tolling systems.
Our expectation was that when we raised the price, that fewer people would consume the good, which is what you typically find.
So imagine his surprise when higher prices actually drew more cars into the lanes.
People don't normally think about driving on high occupancy toll lanes as a prestige good.
Where people perceive more value as the price goes up. On the other hand, Levinson says, maybe there is a real value.
So if you're a type A person, you know, you might get some sort of psychological benefit from passing 20 other cars on your way to work. Even if by passing 20 cars, you've only saved yourself a minute or two. You're ahead in the race. So as a positional good, you think it's better.
And for the record, express lanes may or may not be better as the price goes up. Dynamic tolling changes to ensure free-flowing traffic in the express lanes. It has nothing to do with what's going on in the not-so-express lanes. But economist Tony Villamil thinks there's a bigger point here.
Everybody's fast, fast, fast.
Villamil's with the Washington Economics Group, and a willingness to pay, he says, is a refusal to wait. It's further evidence that the value of a second is higher than ever.
Maybe 20 years ago, people would say, why not take the more congested route? Time was not of essence like it is today in the business world.
It's been an hour now since Kevin Serino chose not to take the express lanes. And the thing is, it wasn't the money that scared him off.
The one thing I wish I had more of was time. You know, it's not money, it's not a better job or a better car, it's just I wish I had more time.
Serino learned that when the 95 express lanes were at their $7 max, authorities had clearly lost control of congestion, something they hoped to regain by raising the max to $10.50. Kevin Serino pulls into his driveway about 30 minutes later than he'd like.
I'm pretty tired out.
He walks up to his door,
Dad,
kisses his wife and kids. He pulls Scarlett out of her playpen, and she scrambles up onto the couch.
Ooh! Have you seen her do that before? Climb up onto the couch? I haven't seen her do that yet.
Serino says he would gladly pay $10.50 for 30 extra minutes of moments like that. In Miami, I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
Coming up, everybody gets a prize.
If your car has not won any award whatsoever, that's probably a bad sign.
Yeah. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, listen to that. The Dow Industrials pumped back up 227 points, 1.4%. ended at 16,395. The NASDAQ gained 74 points, 1.75%, finished at 43.51. The S&P 500 added 28 points, 1.5%, 1873. Record highs all over the place. Delta Airlines soared 5.7% today, reporting strong demand from domestic flyers. JCPenney put on 4% after Standard & Poor's said the retailer's outlook, quote, has begun to stabilize. Apple grew 0.2% on news that its chief financial officer is going to retire later this year. He's going to be a pilot, in fact. Facebook flew up 2% on rumors that it might buy a solar drone manufacturer. Yes, drones for Facebook. What could possibly go wrong? Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up tomorrow. The Federal Reserve issues its Beige Book Summary of Commentary on Current Economic Conditions. 35 years ago, Jupiter got its close-up when Voyager 1 made its closest approach to the planet. The spacecraft's journey continues. It has since entered interstellar space. And tomorrow is Ash Wednesday, the beginning of Lent. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Radio Shack announced today it's going to be closing as many as 1,100 stores, about 20% of its total. Sales are way down for the electronics retailer the past couple of years, which has been trying to reinvent itself again. You know, it's easy for people to make fun of Radio Shack in this digital age, but as Marketplace's David Weinberg reports, for all of its struggles, Radio Shack is one of this country's great business success stories.
Radio Shack has tried to be the go-to store for a number of new electronic products. It started in the 20s with radios. For a lot of kids who grew up in the 80s, though, that product was the remote control car.
Remember that piece of crap? It's attached to a cord. I'm going to go take my Corvette for a walk now. So, thank you, Dad. Best Christmas ever.
That's Rob Marr, one of many, many comedians who have bits about Radio Shack, a store that has been reinventing itself for decades. Radio Shack was founded in Boston in 1921 by two brothers, Theodore and Milton Deutschman. But by the 1960s, the company was floundering. Then along came Charles Tandy, who had a company that sold leather goods. He bought Radio Shack and changed the name to Tandy Radio Shack and Leather. The leather business didn't last long.
We were kind of the parts place. You could go and get resistors, transistors, capacitors, that type of thing.
Gary L. Hunter teaches marketing in Illinois State, and for 17 years he worked at Radio Shacks in North Carolina and Kentucky. Hunter worked at the company in the 80s when a new product came along called the computer.
Oh, yeah. I sold Tandy computers. We sold compact computers for a while.
The company, in its latest incarnation, wants to be a mobile phone store. But it's not working.
It's tough for any retailer to sell and make significant margins on cell phones.
George Lowe is dean of the Neely School of Business at Texas Christian University in the Tandy building, named after Charles Tandy. He says Radio Shack has managed to stay alive because it's everywhere.
It's convenient for people to go pick up whatever it is they need to pick up, and that's why they survive.
There are over 5,000 Radio Shacks around the country, but not for long. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
With the caveat that nobody knows what tomorrow is going to bring, we are 5 days away from the anniversary of the post-Great Recession bull market. March 9, 2009, 5 years ago, was the low on Wall Street, the end of the bear market, brought to us by the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Bulls and bears, oh my, how did those two animals come to be associated with the stock market? Anyhow, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore fills us in.
Okay, take a listen to this. Here is what a bull sounds like. And here is what a bear sounds like. Got that? Bull. Bear. Market's up. Market's down. Now, hearing that, you might be able to tell where these terms came from. Just kidding, you totally can't, because they make, like, zero sense.
It's a little obscure.
John Steele Gordon is an economic historian.
These terms are very old. They go back to virtually the dawn of stock speculation in the early 18th century.
Gordon says there are a lot of origin theories out there, and the most common one is about how the two animals attack.
The bull will lower his horns and then toss his enemy up, and the bear will swipe down with his claws.
Okay, so there's that idea that the stock market is like how different kinds of animals gore people to death, but there are a lot of other theories, and most of them are wrong, or at least totally unproven. Ben Zimmer is the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, people like coming up with theories.
He says the term bear market or bearish most likely comes from an old saying that goes, don't sell the bear skin before you've caught the bear. Because back in the early 1700s, that's kind of what some traders started doing.
There are a lot of speculators engaging in what we would now call short selling, selling stocks that they did not yet own, with the expectation that by the time it was due for delivery, the price would fall and the speculator would get a profit.
Basically, if people thought the market was going down, they'd try to make a quick buck.
That was called selling the bear skin, based on the old proverb.
Over time, that got shortened to bear.
So we have a pretty good sense of the bear part of bull and bear. The bull is a little more mysterious.
Or maybe it's obvious, bull proudly charging ahead. But basically, we don't know. I personally vote for the gory disembowelment theory because I get to say gory disembowelment again. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
If you're in the market for a new car, or maybe you just bought one and you really like it, you're probably familiar with all those best of car awards, maybe from J.D. Power or Motor Trend. Those, you've seen them, I'm sure. Well, not to rain on your parade too terribly much, but here is the dirty little secret about them. It's really, really, really easy to win one of those things. Eric Chemmy is the head of research for Bloomberg Businessweek and Bloomberg TV. He tallied up all of those awards. Eric, it's good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
You know what this is like? This is like my six-year-old's soccer team at the end of the season where you get a trophy and you get a trophy and you get a trophy and you get a trophy. Everybody gets a trophy in the car evaluation business. What the heck?
Exactly. If you manufactured a car, you get an award from somebody. And this goes back all the way to at least the 50s. It might even be the 40s, but safe to say from well before we were ever born.
We have, we've got most appealing, we've got most dependable, we've got, highest rated in quality. There are, I can't even tell you how many different categories there are, bunches.
Well, if you look at J.D. Power, because they are the big one, that's why you see them a lot. They have three different categories with 23 types of classes of cars, except one category only has 22. But you add it all up, and it's 68 total possible cars could be the number one best car in a category in its class.
So if I'm going out to buy a car, should I even bother with this stuff?
I mean, I guess you should look at if your car has not won any award whatsoever, that's probably a bad sign.
But if you had to pick one, what do you pick? Best in class? Do you pick car of the, Motor Trend car of the year?
I wouldn't look at any individual award because, for example, Consumer Reports said the Tesla Model S was their best overall car.
Too much fanfare, right? Much fanfare.
Right. But they had 10 best picks. So the Tesla wasn't necessarily the best sports sedan. That was a different car. It wasn't the best green car. That was a different car. The Tesla wasn't necessarily the most reliable car. So it depends what matters to you.
Yeah. Well, what matters to me is price, but that's a whole different interview. There have been some clunkers out there, right? I mean, you point out that in 1971, the Chevy Vega was the best car on the planet, basically?
Exactly, and they disappeared. Or the Motor Trend car of the year in 2002 was the Ford Thunderbird. That wasn't even on the market 3 years later.
Is it a business advantage for people to do this? I mean, Car and Driver has it, Motor Trend has it, Popular Mechanics, Kelley Blue Book, they all do this stuff.
They all do it, and I think it's helpful for two different groups. It's helpful for these content providers, all these magazines and websites. They're all enthusiast type of publications. So they get the benefit of having commercials tout the credibility of their award on television. And then the car companies get the credibility of winning an award from these publications. So both sides of it definitely benefit.
Much like the tree falling in the forest thing, if all these awards went away, would anybody notice?
I'm not sure. I think we would notice on television commercials, though, because then there would be a lot less to say in between our football games.
What do you drive?
I drive a Vespa in New York City.
No, do you really?
I do. So the snow is killing me because I can't go out when it's snowy.
Eric Chemmy is the head of research at Bloomberg Businessweek. Eric, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, two of them actually. First of all, LARPing. Now that I know what it is, no, sadly not for me. But thanks to all of you for cluing me in as to live action role playing. I appreciate that. Second of all, and no, I am not making this up. You've heard of Airbnb, right? People using the internet to rent out their apartments. Well, perhaps this was inevitable, but we have now come to, and cover your ears if you are the sensitive type, Airbnb. Seriously, it's a real thing. I'm just going to read from their website. It's a quote, "When there aren't enough bathrooms nearby for the amount of people in any given location, Airbnb is there to save the day," end of quote. There is a mobile app coming soon, apparently. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow up 227 points. The NASDAQ gained 74 points. The S&P 500 added 28 points on an up day all the way around. Nancy Fargali is the special projects producer. John Ketchum is the producer on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Raghu Manavalan. I'm Kai Rizdal. I don't produce anything. I just talk into the microphone. We'll see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.